Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 31st, 2006, and today's session is entitled What Eyes Can See and Hearts Can Hear, presented by Jonathan Frericks, number FRJ 2006-01. Let's listen in.
Buddy, my name's Jonathan Frericks. This session is called Risking Love. This series is called Risking Love in the Holy Land, From Facts to Faith. And every word in that title, I hope, will mean something more to you than in this context than perhaps it does now from the typical kind of treatment we have of this issue. And the session today is called What Eyes Can See and Hearts Can Hope. And I want to try to come at this from the perspective of our eyes and our hearts as the key kind of anchor we need as people of faith to come to terms with this most troubling crisis in that part of the world. And I don't plan to spend huge amounts of time on the actual events that are happening right now. We can certainly discuss them, but it's part of what I'd like to try to do with you to help you not rise above, but see through the events that are happening, because they'll keep happening until some fundamental things change. And what's happening today is absolutely no different, except in speed and in firepower, than what's happening every day. And you hear my first piece of bias in this kind of a session. I work for the World Council of Churches. I work in the International Affairs Department of the World Council of Churches. I'm responsible for advocacy in the Middle East and also for the issue of disarmament. In the rest of the week, we will move beyond this kind of experiential approach with a little bit of legal and political discussion to ways of trying to move from facts to faith and to sharing examples of people who are actually in the about the business of saving this most special place on earth. I really believe that the Holy Land is being saved, even as we listen and speak with such concern, because of the actions of certain kinds of people there who have a lot to teach us. The Middle East, just as a little bit of an intro, I think is really worth pondering, and especially in this week where the Bible study this morning set a tone that is not so far off some of the things that might occur to you as we talk now. I think it's fair to say that the Middle East is really the middle. It's the middle of the human experience. It's the middle of human history. It's certainly the crossroads of the world from any number of angles, in terms of civilizations, in terms of cultures, in terms of commerce, conquests, and of course, religions. Many religions have sprung up there, and three of them, monotheistic religions, if you like, have gained some sort of allegiance among about half the people in the human race. Of course, Christianity, of course, Islam, and of course, Judaism. But if a globalizing world is a more complex place, I think it's fair to say that the Middle East crisis that's been going on for all of our lifetimes is perhaps the most complex crisis in the world, and now probably also the longest crisis in the world. It's as if the fault lines of the modern world all intersect in one spot. And the ones that come to my mind, you might be able to add a couple yourself, are the fault lines of history, of culture, of ethnicity, and slash racism, if you like, of economy, including resource exploitation, resource use, resource control, of course, petroleum, of traditional things versus modern things, of theocratic, theology gone sort of a little wild in the political sphere. And I think one really important way to frame the crisis is to think of a 19th century problem that ruined most of the 20th century and has now been fused with a 21st century problem. And the 19th century problem is colonialism. And it's ruined most of the 20th century in the Middle East, and it's still ruining it. And now it's being fused with the 21st century problem, which is the war on terror. It's metastasized, if you like. Not resolved, rather than being resolved, metastasized into a new and actually deeply more troubling dimension because of the advent of the war on terror. I'm mostly concentrating, and this session will concentrate on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And if that's the Holy Land, which of course is a problematic term, it's certainly at the heart of the Middle East crisis of the last 90, going on 100 years, because all of these fault lines come together there more powerfully than in any other place, I think. And it strikes me that if this is a place, the Holy Land is a place where the human race can and must confront both its highest hopes and its deepest flaws. I think there's no place on the planet where that dichotomy between our highest hopes and our deepest flaws as human beings is laid quite so bare. In that same breath, I want to say to you that I have to get into deep water pretty quickly here with you, I think, and we do together. And I think to do that as Christians and to do that in the spirit of Holden, it's real important to try to balance that highest of hopes category with that deepest of flaws, and to find a way to talk about this issue through these sessions with that in mind. And I'd like you to try to share your own opinions, but doing to them what I'm trying to do to mine, which is to hold them up to that balance that we have. I think that the challenge to do that is really important. One way to lay the groundwork for this as people, in order to be able to learn about it, to discuss it, and to perhaps come to some new levels of engagement, is to acknowledge that we all have feelings about what's going on there. And I just thought it'd be worth taking a little time here to write down a bunch of adjectives, one word each, whoever wants to share. What feelings do you have about this crisis? I'll put a few of these adjectives on the board for us to remember.
Tragedy,
okay. Other ones?
Unresolvable.
Hopeless. Anguishing.
Exasperation.
Selfish.
Wait just a second here. Selfish.
Betrayal. Betrayal.
Sorry, this is for being betrayed by the magic marker right here.
Fear of being labeled anti-Semitic.
So, okay, fear of anti-Semitism.
Anger.
Deceived.
Anger. Deceived.
Confused.
Inequality.
Fearful of our government's response.
Okay. Well.
Jonathan, we are confused.
Confused, that's a good one. Okay.
Responsible.
Responsible. Wow. Okay. There may be more, and we can add them.
Unjust.
Unjust. Okay, we'll end with that one.
I can feel anxiety just talking about it.
Yeah, and we can get into a lot of trouble here by what I say or by what you think or what you say. So let's keep that in front of us and try to work through it. And try to do something a little different than what tends to happen, I think, in our society on this issue. I wanted to say that as Christians, that idea of balancing highest hopes with deepest flaws, I think, needs to be done on the sort of the fulcrum of God's promise to us. And of course, there are many ways we could talk about God's promise to us. The promise that's got to be operative as we look at this crisis, and as we hang on to the premise that if we believe in God, we cannot give in to all of these adjectives. We can't let that be our epitaph on this issue, where we kind of tune out. You ever had a crisis, a trouble spot in the world where you just had to tune out? You just couldn't follow the news anymore? I'm not sure we can afford to do that with this crisis. Not that we can with any crisis. But I know what happened to me with Northern Ireland when I was in college. I just couldn't hear any more stories about Northern Ireland. And I think in order not to do that, we have to find a promise that's sort of like a fulcrum between those hopes and those flaws. And I found a great one very easily in the newspaper that Holden sent me about this summer. And I'll just read a little part of it. Remember the theme of the summer is, I am with you always. I am with you always. I am with you always. And of course I'm with you in the place that I chose to come and reveal myself. I'm with you always. And the paragraph that I think really speaks is from a prophet, a modern prophet, Desmond Tutu, South African Archbishop, in his book, No Future Without Forgiveness. Speaks to Jesus' unequivocal promise to us, and he also speaks to the challenge. Looking at South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, established after that country's break from apartheid, he maintains that we are made for togetherness, for friendship, for community, for family. We are created to live in a delicate network of interdependence. This creative process, so life is a creative process, says Tutu, is at the heart of the universe. And what each of us can retard or promote, hinder or advance that process. The African word he uses is for interdependence is Ubuntu, which some of you have heard, a feast of images in itself. Ubuntu means humanity, compassion, goodness, and especially interrelationship. Ubuntu carries the meaning that in order to be fully human, one has to be in community. Tutu has used the word to develop a theology of reconciliation that helps us to understand how we might help to heal a broken world. And if there's one theme to kind of help us to discuss this crisis, I think it's this. And even though we probably aren't blessed, are there any Jewish people here? Praise the Lord. Praise. I was going to say, we probably aren't blessed with any Jewish people. And any Muslims? Okay, we're not blessed with any Muslims. But this is the one sheep and the 99 sheep, to have somebody who identifies himself as a Jewish person is part of what I'm trying to say we need to think about. And I'm sorry if I'm calling attention. But whatever we say has to be tested against what we can say in the presence of the people that are implicated in this crisis, and ourselves included. And how can we say things which are in fact a witness to our faith? If we are going to criticize, I think we need to criticize according to the standard of, say, the Holden theme that Tutu has explained in that way. If we're going to affirm according to that promise. And to not be able to relate what's happening in the Middle East to our faith, and to not be able to discern ways forward that are a witness to the gospel, I think is a profound failure of our religion. And I've just begun to think, against my own best instincts, that we really could be headed for something quite terrible, something like that thing in the 90s about the clash of civilizations. Something like, I'm sorry to say it, something like World War III, if we don't come to terms with some of the dynamics that are taking place there. Because in my opinion, for as long as I've been involved with the issue, which is now 16 years of personal contact, I agree with what the Palestinians say. We didn't think it could get any worse, but it has. And I've heard them say that convincingly, and I've seen with my own eyes what they mean by that again and again and again. And there are precedents to everything. There are precedents to what's happening in Lebanon. But when they come back, and they come back again, and sometimes more terribly, you have to really wonder if anything that we've been seeing lately is very much in line of a solution, or is if it's really going in the wrong direction. And take courage to try to see your way through that. I want to try to offer two short pieces of bread and then a rather a thick slice of salami or cheese or hummus in the middle of this sandwich. The two short pieces are legal and political comments on the paths to peace. There are plenty of paths to peace. They're just not being taken. And I hope you take away from each session some understanding of that. One outline a legal one, and at the end a political one. And in between, kind of deal with the human, the spiritual, the common sense, the down-to-earth, the grassroots, the person-to-person path to peace. The legal one can be very shortly described. It's in about half a dozen UN resolutions. And the most famous of all is UN Security Council Resolution 242, from a few months after the 1967 war, in which they said that this land, the UN Security Council voted this, and they wouldn't be able to vote it today, which is very interesting. They would never be able to put this resolution out the door today because things have gone that wrong from the good sense of what makes sense as a solution. One land equitably shared between two people, the two people who claim it, two peoples who claim it. And regional recognition, legitimacy, and in other ways this has been affirmed, the security and full relations for Israel. This is added on top of an earlier UN decision in 1949 when they dealt with the toughest problem of all, the holy city itself, Jerusalem, in the UN partition plan. And remember, if you know your history, there was an earlier partition plan of Palestine, and then the 1948 war where the boundaries were moved to the Israeli advantage and the Palestinian disadvantage to roughly where they were until 1967. And then in the armistice, there was a plan for Jerusalem to be a corpus separatum. You know, you use Latin when you want to say something important. Jerusalem was to be an international city separate from either body of the two nations which should be on that land if you want to have some kind of solution. And it would be a one city for two peoples and three faiths, open to the world, internationally guaranteed. And the UN is the guarantor of the status of Jerusalem. The United Nations itself is the guarantor of the status of Jerusalem. So if you add that policy together with Resolution 242, you have the basic legal outline, and UN Security Council resolutions have the power of international law. You want to learn about international law? The United Nations is able to make international law at the Security Council level. It's not very well observed, but we got to go there unless we want to go to the jungle. And this one lays it out in a very common sense way. It's been affirmed many, many ways, and most dramatically in 2002 by the Arab League in Beirut, when they basically accepted it. And accepting it means accepting Israel. The big bugbear that we always hear is never solved. It is solved. It's been solved. It just needs to be recognized. It needs to be actualized. So that's a legal path to peace. Open, like a freeway. But there's nobody on it. And there's been nobody on it for several years. Yes?
Isn't the other part of 242 the ending of the illegal occupation of the West Bank by Israel?
If you go to this, it defines the 67 borders, and that implies obviously the ending of the occupation. I'm trying not to go into too many details here, but have some faith that some good minds came up with a solution which would work better than anything that's been tried by disobeying these Security Council resolutions. Thank you for that, Jennifer. The things I'd like to spend a little time on are this sort of human common sense grassroots, which I think also then becomes quite quickly spiritual, paths to peace. And I'd like to take you on a trip to experience a little bit of that human scale, because that's what we can all appreciate, and that's what's most real, and that's where you see the effects of things gone wrong most dramatically. How many of you have been to either Israel or Palestine or both? Okay. My premise would be the best way to go is almost like as a silent movie. Because something that's been on my mind for a long time is that words are almost meaningless now in this conflict. The words we hear on the news, the words we hear from our leaders, a lot of the commentary, it's almost meaningless because they have been so, there's plenty of good thinking out there, and of course it's expressed in words, but they've been so abused and unaddressed that it's just better to use your eyes. So consider this a silent visit. Turn off the sound, and we're going to go up to Jerusalem and then out to the West Bank and then pay a little visit to Galilee. And going up to Jerusalem is at a time that could be exactly right now, but it was actually 4 years ago when the big operation came on the heels of the Second Intifada to try to put the genie back in the bottle and shut down the West Bank and Gaza. And there had been a heavy period of combat between the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, and the Palestinian communities and the militias who took up arms against them. And I found myself in a rush hour going up to Jerusalem from the airport, just arrived in Israel and Palestine. And it was the most extraordinary rush hour because there were two kinds of trucks in that rush hour. There were incredibly long and big and huge trucks carrying incredibly wide and huge 90-ton Merkava tanks that were covered in mud because they'd been so busy. It was rain. It was springtime. There's rains in Palestine and Israel in the spring, and these tanks were covered in mud. And there were 15 of these huge battle tanks on the back of tank transporters, right mixed in with the Toyotas and the Subarus of Jerusalem, Israeli Jerusalem commuter traffic. There's one other kind of truck. There was only one of them. It was a flatbed. It had a little tiny pile of something underneath a tarpaulin, and I looked at it real hard and tried to figure out what it was. And I figured out that it was tents. The trucks for me had two different messages. The 90-ton Merkava tanks and their transporters were saying to the commuters who had to sit there and look at them as we climbed these long hills to Jerusalem, the message was, we're at war. We're at war. And oh, by the way, this war is normal. War is normal around here. It's every day. It's something that happens. We're on our way home to get cleaned and repaired, and then we're going to go back out and fight for you again. The other truck was speechless. It was trying to say something, but it wasn't being heard, because on it were tents provided by USAID for Palestinians who had been made homeless by the tanks. And I read in the paper the next day that when the tents arrived at the place where the destruction had taken place, they were refused. The Palestinians said, we'd rather sleep under the stars than have these tents from the same people who are allied with the tanks that have just destroyed our homes. The next day I went out to the West Bank to one of five village clinics run by the Lutheran World Federation, Augusta Victoria Hospital on the Mount of Olives, with their Palestinian staff, where they've had to decentralize their health care and bring it down to the village clinic level in order to help people who can't get to the hospital anymore because of the restrictions on Palestinian movement. And so you get a health clinic functioning as a full-service hospital to people who have no other option. And this is, again, 2002, but it's only worse today. There were already the 300, 400, 500, or 600 barriers, roadblocks, rocks across the road that have chopped the West Bank up into a no-go zone for its own inhabitants. And to get to the clinic, we had to go down an Israeli freeway with our East Jerusalem plate, which was authorized to do that, a freeway made for settlers. We had to come to a gas station. Behind the gas station was the road we really wanted to take, but it was blocked by a big berm of earth and by a whole bunch of boulders. So the hospital staff took their bus, they wrote a note, they put it in the windshield. They said, dear IDF, this bus belongs to Augusta Victoria Hospital. We're going to a village. They wrote exactly what was happening so that nobody would think it was some kind of a terrorist vehicle that had been abandoned. We climbed over the boulders. We went down a path. And at the bottom was a village taxi into which we climbed, which took us off to a village called Beit Lakia. Now, Beit Lakia at that point had been under siege basically for 8 months. There are 15,000 people living there. And the one doctor on this visiting team, I watched him in 4 hours, and this makes your HMO look good. In 4 hours, this one doctor treated 79 people. 79 people. Everybody from someone with terminal cancer to someone with a common cold. And this was just an average morning. We went back to Augusta Victoria, the hospital in East Jerusalem, run by the Lutheran World Federation. I had a closer look at this most personal of elements you could see. What's your health? How's your health? How does it fare with where you live and your circumstances? And I met a man who was so swollen, so out of his element, so like a fish out of water. He looked like he'd been landed some days ago and left to rot. He was just bloated in that way and discolored, like a puffed up fish. His name was Abdel Majud Awes. And he's one of the, you could say, millions of Palestinians and Israelis who've been, whose individual lives are incredibly compounded by the problems of the occupation. The occupation is so toxic to Awas that he is swollen and disfigured and panting for every breath a good part of each week. Why? He needs dialysis. There's a dialysis machine 10 minutes from his house in the town of Nablus. When I saw him at this period of trouble, which has now basically been institutionalized and made permanent, he had gone, first of all, for 2 weeks. He's supposed to get dialysis every 2 days. He had gone 2 weeks without it. Why? Because every time he tried to get to the one 10 minutes from his house, the IDF refused him passage. Then he called an ambulance to take him to Jerusalem, and the ambulance was stopped by soldiers and turned back. This went on for 2 weeks. Finally, and he did something very typical, people cope in amazing ways, a friend of his piggybacked him over the hill to a road which didn't have a roadblock, which would get him onto another road which could get him to East Jerusalem. At this point, he weighed 250 pounds, 40 or 50 pounds of which I understood to be the fluids that he had, was building up because of the lack of a dialysis treatment. It took a 3-hour ride in a taxi to Jerusalem, and that's what he then has to do. And he only does it once a week. The doctor says every 2 days, he can't get to the one near his house. He comes to Jerusalem every once a week, to have the dialysis done. Partly to save money, partly because of the problem of getting there, and partly to help his wife keep their little shop open so that they can continue to live. You could say that the frequency of his treatments is tempting fate for Awas. Now you visit a place like that, like the West Bank in East Jerusalem. You visit Awas's crowded ward full of overdue kidney patients, and you have to go back to your room and just rest. Just let your brain clear and your heart settle down. And in this case, I had been in the Holy Land for less than 24 hours, and all those things had happened to me. And I think that it's a small taste, as a foreigner, of what Palestinians living under occupation go through every day in a much more intense and costly fashion than anyone from outside can ever experience. And there would be varieties of this experience where Israelis have been severely impacted by the occupation as well, and we could tell a similar story. Although some of the particulars would be different, their access to care and so on. There are bigger facts than this, of course, not just the personal dimension, and I'd like to point to a couple of them, which maybe aren't news to all of you, but need to be said. We in this country always hear about employment prospects, and it's worth saying that in Palestine, unemployment has been higher than employment for at least 5 years, maybe six, maybe seven, and it doesn't seem to be going away. That seems to be the state of things. After 6 years of this uprising and 13 years since the Oslo Accords, that's the direction where people see it. Two-thirds of the population live on $2 a day. The per capita income before the current isolation, which followed the election of the Hamas government, the per capita income was $1,500 a year. And that's 1/12 of the per capita income in Israel, which is an average of 18,000. But I think the most dramatic fact of all really is the impact of the settlements on the situation. And I'd like to play you about 4 minutes of a 2001 video in which settlements are shown. And no less a person than Condoleezza Rice said after her first trip, "I saw the settlements. You can't tell me they aren't a problem." And it's really interesting that a Secretary of State of the United States would say that at that point in her career, that she's like seeing is believing. And I think it's important for us to again, trust our eyes to tell us what this is like. If someone over there can hit that light, I will look for the switch. There's one that controls this one.
In the land located, pro by the government.
Our target is to be righteous, to build houses according to the master plan.
This part has always been attached to Zionist planning ever since the past 100 years. Plans that were made up in the 1930s and 40s, certain areas, not out here so much, closer to Jerusalem, and other areas were simply taken out of the files and renewed. Not focused?
No.
Ryan's still here?
Built with taxes from a country.
Turn that front lamp, so I'll do it.
Here, it's
red. So it's not quite.
I'd be faster.
Yeah, I'm calling.
Can you read the writing?
No.
You can say that you don't have.
Settlements usually started on public grazing lands. Then the Israeli army declares the surrounding land off limits to Palestinians for security reasons.
Well, first of all, I don't feel surrounded by Arabs. I look up the window and I see empty land. I'm not
Israeli
surrounded by anybody. I'm just surrounded by hills and rocks and emptiness.
Once Israelis move in, Palestinians are forbidden to even walk across their old lands. As though the land itself has been carried away.
We're up here now in the top neighborhood of Shiloh, which was established in 1981, about 3.5 years after the first 8 families came here to Shiloh. We have about 50, 55 families in this neighborhood.
Nablus in the West Bank.
This is my great-great-grandfather, Kassel. His name is Mahmoud Beit Abdelhadi. He was the governor of Jabal Nablus during the Ottomans. This Kassel, the family's old house, about 200 years old, maybe a little bit more.
I'm not too political, but what I want is all of this. I feel that all of this is ours, and this must also become ours. Greta moved here from Russia. As settlements for Jews are being built, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes. Any destruction by the occupying power of real or personal property is prohibited, of the quote. More than 2,000 Palestinian families' homes are destroyed.
Okay, we'll stop it there. The part of the beginning before we got it started out, quoted the Geneva Convention. Could you put the cap back on that, please? According to the Geneva Convention, which says that if you occupy territory, you're not allowed to move your own population into it. And the Geneva Convention is part of a real interesting phenomenon where we have international law. We have a lot of very pragmatic decision-making about how to deal with war. It's not for pacifists because it admits that war will happen, but it says if you're going to have a war, these are the minimum standards to observe. We all know about minimum standards in work, etc. And one of them in war is that if you conquer territory, you can't annex it and you can't move your people there. You also can't kick out the people that live there. And the last was a quote, and the first had a quote from the Geneva Conventions. The numbers of demolished houses is higher, the number of settlers is higher since this was made. The trend just keeps on going. And one of the neat things about Israel is they have a free press, and they have a strong tradition of independent thinkers, people making research, and even government inquiries, which actually dig quite deep. And they had an investigation called the Sassoon Report, and the conclusion of the Sassoon Report was that every Israeli government, Labor or Likud, that has been in power since the establishment of the settlement program has supported it, has made it possible. You saw a brief reference to it here, where you get a better mortgage, you get land, you get a better house, you get a better living situation if you take advantage of this option to go and live in a settlement on occupied territory. And so you have this peculiar light shed on the problem at the same time as the problem goes on and on and on. A little bit of time on hearts and hope. And again, I turn to the same people that we were just speaking about. I was going to live in Jerusalem once and was getting to know my future landlord. And after only two short visits to the shop that he ran, he invited me to come and see where he was from. And so we went down from Jerusalem, down to the rich plains, the coastal plain, to a part in what is now Israel proper. On back roads, we put a keffiyeh on the dashboard as we went through the Palestinian villages, because with his plates, even as a Palestinian, he could be stoned, because they might think it's a Jerusalemite from Israel. And we came to one of the three places that is the biblical Emmaus. There are three places that could be Emmaus. It's called Amwas in Arabic. And it and two other villages were erased in 1967 because they were on a piece of land that stuck into Israel after it had lived with those borders from 1948 for long enough. And when they got control, they wiped those three villages out and just made the border straight there in that area. And so the villages were, I think, some of the hundreds, there's something like 500 such villages that were bulldozed. And he took me around and showed me where he had grown up, where the church was, where the school was, where his house had been. And at one point we came to a big reef of prickly pear cactus. And the interesting thing is, and the Palestinians always tell you this, the bulldozers couldn't get the cactus spores or didn't get the cactus spores out of the ground. And so the cactuses that used to be used to line off the livestock's fields and the yards between the homes come back. And we stood by this huge reef of cactus, and he said, if this cactus could speak, it would know me, because this was the boundary of our property here. I saw him go from an occupied person to a person full of hope in that little outing, because to be back on his land just put a shine in his step, a bounce in his step, and a shine in his face. And we covered a bit more territory in that part of the world, and came across some Palestinian homes just over the Green Line in Palestine. And people gave us fresh vegetables and freshly made bread, Palestinian bread, and we had a picnic out in the field. And there was just a sense of the connection that you don't often feel anymore between the people and the land that they would like to make their country on. A second example of hope is from 2 months ago in Hebron, where I went to see a woman who runs a school in the old city of Hebron. Now, Hebron is 100,000 people with a very radical settlement on the fringes of town, and then extremely radical settlers, three small settlements. I'm talking two trailers, a Palestinian home, and some kind of a prefabricated unit. That's one settlement.
A Palestinian home?
Israeli settlement. They took the Palestinian home over, they brought in the two trailers, and then they have a prefab of some kind, and that's a settlement. Those five dwellings. And
Jonathan, could you explain who lives in settlements? Because I'm not sure people are clear.
Settlements are Israelis who are living on occupied territory.
Where do they come from? Are they part of the diaspora the Israelites who moved to many different nations and now they're being called back to their homeland?
You saw on here, the one woman said Greta?
Yes.
She said, I believe this is all ours. She's from Russia, and she was brought there in the early 90s.
And there are Americans who are also going back to them.
The biggest group of settlers are American Jewish people. And by calling them settlers means they're settling on occupied territory.
And some of them are Messianic Jews as well.
Yeah. Hebron is one of the weirdest cases because you have 100,000 Palestinians, and I think in these three little settlements, less than 200, or even less than that, Israelis who have who are now parked in what they've managed to get a hold of in the old town of Hebron. And their presence and the protection of them by the army means that the several thousand Palestinians with homes in the old city of Hebron have left. A few are hanging on, but they're gradually leaving because it's just not worth trying to live there anymore because the whole thing is under quarantine. And to get to your house, you have to get past the soldiers, and they will frisk you to see that you don't have anything that will do damage to these settlers, who are kind of like a, you know, it's hard to say what the image would be, but they're there, and they're slowly expanding their control. The reason that we're involved there is there's a school, a Palestinian school, a Muslim school, that used to have 300 students, and it's right below one of these little settlements. And there's a headmistress who's kept the school open to this day, even though the 300 students has gone down to 97 students. And they're elementary school kids. And to get to school every day, they have to come from different parts of that old town and from beyond the borders of the old town and be escorted in this case, by international volunteers. You may have heard of the CPT, the Christian Peacemakers Team, Peacemaker Teams. They do some of it, and the World Council of Churches program, the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel, does some of this as well. Walking elementary school Palestinian kids to school every day, staying with them every day, and then walking them home to their homes, which are sometimes right below one of the settlers' houses. And they make a point of going around the front to get in the front door of their house, because if they don't, that street will be taken. So it's like users' rights. You know, even though it is their land and their place, they have to keep using as much of it as possible in order to keep the settlers from taking more and more of the land. And in the short time I was there, it was Shabbat, and a settler family passed these school children. And you know how do you as your family look going to church? These people were all in their Shabbat best clothing. The father was pushing a pram. There were two or three little kids. The mother was carrying another one, probably five children. Nice family walking down the street. But they're coming from their house to the synagogue right past the Palestinian school, and the father has an Uzi over his back on his way to synagogue. And there's absolutely no eye contact between them and the little children who are going to school, whose very possibility to stay there is at risk because of the presence of the settlers. It's the most extraordinary circumstance you can imagine. It makes no sense whatsoever. And the soldiers, with whom the Palestinians are sometimes in good relations, and the international volunteers are in good relations, if they can be, have this strange deal of trying to prevent violence, but not being really able to deal with the issue, which is the fact that the settlement has been established there and is being protected as part of Israeli policy. For what? There's absolutely no viability to the plan, unless they intend to take over all of Hebron. But you get a kind of a microcosm of the small wedge under the door, which then grows and ruins life for more and more people in this place, which is, of course, holy to Muslims and holy to Jewish people because of the Tomb of the Patriarchs in one part of town. I feel a little bit like sometimes the only holy place left in the Holy Land is the concept of hope itself. And that sometimes that's the only place where you can see God amid all of this trouble. In the idea of hope, in the way hope burns in people like that headmistress who refuses to close the school, who sees her children go past settler teenagers every day, who spit on them, who kick them. 2 weeks before I was there, a settler teenager took a big rock and hit a Swiss volunteer from our program in the head with a big rock, a teenage boy, and they go on. She came right back after the hospital and kept on with her job. That sense of commitment, of hope that what is right needs to be lifted up is incredibly strong after 58 years of occupation, and as a way to remind us that perhaps we need to look in places like that and take as much comfort as we can in the current circumstances from people who keep that going. I'd like to pause for a little bit of questions and discussion and then spend a little bit of time on a political path to peace. But is there something that you're desperately wanting to ask or confused about?
I just want to get clear. So the land that the Jewish people are moving into, moving their settlements into, belongs politically to what country?
It's occupied Palestinian land. The whole area between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, until immediately after World War II, was occupied, was inhabited by the Palestinian people, with some Jewish settlers who had been coming in ever greater numbers since about the turn of the century.
And they're nomadic.
Which?
Historically nomadic. I'm saying there's no country boundary, political boundary, that says this is Lebanon or
come on Wednesday or Thursday. I'm gonna talk history.
Because like it seems to me that like the Israeli settlements, Jewish settlements are this is inciting conflict.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You got it. It's outside of Israel, the country.
Well, what is Israel is the question. Israel was created in a place where other people already lived. And it was created from London.
Yes.
By the British Empire in 1917. Okay, the idea of Jewish return to their homeland. And we can have a great discussion about the fact that the Jewish people need a homeland. And they have one. It's just a question of how big it can be. And it's basically trying to be bigger than it can be if you want to have peace.
Yeah.
And this just keeps happening. How big can it be? And because Israel has power, it's trying to make it basically all the way to the Jordan River. There are going to be pockets that'll be have Palestinians in them, but they won't be viable as a homeland. And from the Palestinian perspective, it was all theirs, even though there were Jewish settlers and Jewish people who had come in this movement to go back to the Holy Land, where they were evicted, in the Roman times. The complication comes that if we think in terms of nation states, that part of the world was under the Ottoman Empire. And it crumbled at the time of World War II. And where I said that a 19th century problem has carried over to the 21st century, it's this idea that the crumbling Ottoman Empire was carved up by the British and the French into the states that are now on the map in the Middle East, without Israel at first, and then imposing Israel on something called Transjordan. Or Transjordan and the British Mandate over Palestine. And the wars have moved the border from the little bit the way that the UN shared it between them to where it is today. I could keep going on, but if that makes some clarity.
Yeah.
Is there agreement about where the border is of Israel?
No, that's the whole thing. I think the short answer is the Israeli government wants it to be something, and the Palestinians want it to be something else. The international community has to live by the UN resolutions, or they have to say, we have no international law, we have no international consensus, let might make right.
But what do they live by? This is an elementary question. When there is a map drawn of Israel,
mm-hmm.
does the map depend on who you are?
Absolutely.
Or is there?
Absolutely. If you go to Israel as a tourist and ask for a map, you'll get a map that doesn't show Palestine. There'll be a slight change in the color in the areas that are Area A under the Oslo Accords, which is the part that they sort of gave them the biggest control over, and then Area B and Area C. But it's not there. The one you always see on the news is basically the 67 borders.
Which, under international laws, is the only one that's really sort of recognized as some legal standard.
The only show in town is the pre-67 war borders,
mm-hmm.
with Gaza separated from the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the percentages are right, the 67 borders give 22% of historic Palestine to the Palestinians. And they're willing to settle for that. They're absolutely willing to settle for that. And the whole Middle East willing to settle that. But current Israeli policy wants them to accept 10% of historic Palestine, not 22%. You can only have 10% of what was yours in 1947. And
All the settlements are a way to make that a fait accompli.
And the settlements are within the winnings of the 67 war,
yeah.
Or beyond that? Inside, the winnings of the 67.
It's in the land, they're on the land they occupied in 67,
yes.
In the Six-Day War.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yes, Don.
Where does the hope come in?
Well, stay around. I think it comes in a little... Yeah, I think it comes in already in the ability of certain people to keep their spirits up, to keep their faith alive, to keep the truth alive, to speak out. And I want to spend the last day really talking about people that Israelis, Palestinians, and foreigners who embody that idea of hope. This, to me, is a lot like a lot of the Old Testament situations where the only person speaking the truth was Micah or Isaiah or, you know, whoever those guys were. And I think it may be almost... There are a lot of people who feel that, but very few people who get heard for saying it or manage to say it in a successful way. But the hope is not present in a material sense, if I can say what you see on the ground. What you see on the ground is a big prison for the Palestinians and an expanding first world, wealthy, successful society on the part of the Israelis. And the wall is, I haven't even mentioned the wall, but the wall is just absolutely the most extraordinary statement of anti-hope, So, you know, what's the definition of faith in Hebrews? The assurance of things unseen. This is what we're talking about. Because you cannot see it, except in individuals that you meet.
Sometimes it seems like you have people over here who are predominantly Christian talking about hope. There are two people over there that both stem from the Old Testament. They've got a territorial problem,
mm-hmm.
And they also have a religious problem.
Yeah.
So we're hopeful for them, but they've got to do it, do they not? The UN isn't going to do it.
No, but the UN set this table, and we're the leading power in the UN. We haven't encouraged it to implement its own resolutions. So they have to do it, you could say, but they're not able to do it without our intervention. And the U.S. is absolutely part of the equation. There's no way around that. Steve.
To bring it back to Holden for a second.
Yeah.
What role does the Lutheran Church have? There is a Lutheran Church of Jordan. There's a very well-spoken bishop, Palestinian bishop.
Yeah.
There are several Lutheran congregations in the Transjordan area. What role do we as Lutherans have?
Well, it's also an answer to your question, Don, I think. You listen to Bishop Munib Yunan of the Lutheran Church in the Holy Land. And he's outraged. Nobody put the word outrage on the board. I think it's a great emotion for this situation. But he's also hopeful. And he's also faithful. And I think our role at Holden, and those of you who are Lutherans, those of you who aren't Lutherans, you're welcome to have the Lutherans as your link to the Holy Land, as well as the Jews that you have relations with, but to hear from these people and to not forget what they're saying, and then to bring some of that home and to bring it to your elected representatives. I think there's really no alternative then for more and more people to break the deadlock that holds in Washington around this issue. Because the discourse in our country on this issue is, I don't know what word to use, it's just not helpful. It's just going in the wrong direction. Again, yes?
What's the parallel Israeli public opinion as opposed to the government opinion?
You know, it used to be quite hopeful, quite inspiring. It used to be 60% were ready to do what Resolution 242 says, trade land for peace. Trade the land you occupied for the peace you want. That's the 242. Unfortunately, with the kind of spin that we experience here and that they experience under Sharon and under Olmert and under the terror that they feel from the suicide bombers and from the non-resolution of the issue. That has been shifting, and I don't know what the latest one, Jennifer or somebody, have you heard of late, what percentage are still land for peace? My sense is it's more like 80-20 now. So
it's almost like a fearmometer.
The higher
the fear, the lower the willing to recognize. Basically, there's no recognition of the rights of the Palestinians.
Yeah.
Happens.
And the thing has gone so far, this is really, I think, important. The thing has gone so far that most Israelis have zero contact with Palestinians. And what did I read from Bishop Tutu? What are we supposed to be about? Interrelatedness, you know? They asked the one settler, do you have any contact with your Arab neighbors? And then I don't know if you could read the subtitle. He didn't answer. And the interviewer said in Hebrew, you don't have to, it's okay, you know? He said, he didn't answer. But the number of people who have no contact because of the fear and because now of the barrier is actually very disturbing, because the only way through it is to have contact and to see the other people as human beings. And I mean that both ways. We, those of us who are kind of working on the Palestinian side, got to keep reminding ourselves that Jewish people are exactly the same as us and exactly the same as Palestinians, and vice versa. Yes, sir.
You made the comment earlier that that words are not helpful, that we should look with our eyes and listen with our hearts. But I want to challenge that, because I feel that the words that are being used, for example, are in our society, on the mainline news are, and from our government, are really designed to communicate the sense that we're standing on the sidelines and two parties over there can't get along, mm-hmm. and we're somehow independent of that. And those words brainwash us,
yeah.
and hide from us the fact that we are the primary military sponsor of that violence. So I want to challenge the notion that words are neutral.
I didn't say they're neutral.
That's right, you didn't say
not helpful.
You said they're not helpful.
Yeah.
And I guess you're right. I think that they are hurtful.
Yeah.
I think we as an American people don't want to face the fact that we are brainwashed. But if there's any issue in the world we are brainwashed about, it is this one.
Yeah.
And we have to
we
get there very quickly when we look at our foreign military spending.
Yeah. We're getting close to being out of time. Thank you for the comment. I'd like every day that we're here, you to get some idea that you aren't disconnected from this crisis, and that there's precious need for more people to be engaged in it than currently are, and engaged with hope and with the interests of both peoples at heart. Sitting knitting here is Jennifer, who gave me a card yesterday about something she's been involved in, which was to go to her newspaper, and even then to the Associated Press, after studying how they reported the deaths on both sides. And which deaths got reported? Are all people created equal?
No.
Is every life the same value? Absolutely. Don't we believe that? Don't we have no alternative but to believe that and to act on that? But unfortunately, in our media, that's not true. And ironically, the side that is winning is portrayed as the biggest victim. The side that is the most powerful is portrayed as the, and inflicting the most suffering is portrayed as the most suffering. It's out of joint, and it's not serving either side. It really is not serving you, and not serving us, and not serving the region. But that was an example of a grassroots initiative of the kind that we will need to turn this corner, because our leaders are absolutely malfeasant on this one. And unfortunately, the price of disagreeing with the U.S. has become so high for European countries that they have decided to not disagree so much about Israel-Palestine, probably figuring that it's a lost cause, let it go, and let's not waste any of our precious capital and business prospects with the U.S. by fighting them on that one as well as we did on Iraq. So citizen action is going to be more and more important in the coming years if this is ever going to turn around. And I invite you to talk to Jennifer and hear a bit about what she did with the Oregonian and the way that they covered this. But we should always think of concrete ways to respond to this. Final question here.
Why is our government so biased against the Palestinians? So our support is so far balance, you know, it's out of proportion here. Why is that?
Yeah. Can we have a forum to figure that out? All of us need to help explain that. We all need to help explain that. That could be the lead question. To put our best thinking, and to be honest, because this is not sounding like an average group here. This is not a representative sample of American opinion. Maybe some of you haven't spoken yet, but I encourage you to, you know, because we're not being representative here about this, what I would call bias as well.
So I'll throw a piece in there, coming from the Judeo-Christian tradition, and having just left Seattle, and to pick up the newspaper the day after that, and find that, you know, a mile from where I work downtown,
yeah,
a gunman has gone into a Jewish organization's offices, shot six women, killed at least one,
yeah,
and you respond to that by saying, what? You know, on a personal level, my daughter's best friend is Jewish, very active in her temple,
yeah.
And I grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia where my first best love was an Orthodox rabbi's son, and 60 or 70% of the people there were Jewish who were very much rooted in their tradition. And it was, you know, in a lot of ways part of our tradition too. And the rabbi who spoke here, I don't know if he was back this year, Robert, I forgot his last name.
Marks.
Fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
He's talked with us last year for a week. Every day we went to Bible study with him. And he finally said, you know, somebody asked him some questions. He said, the Messiah of the Old Testament is a Messiah rooted in territory,
mm-hmm,
in political life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the Messiah of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from the Bible. In his view, that was his, you know, that's his, he said, you know, we don't have time to go into that now, but you should know that that's the view. So to balance, you know, that and look at the real pain that we see from our side and from, you know, personal connections of looking at this and saying, you know, how do we understand this better so that we can say there is such thing as a homeland for the Jews, there should be,
mm-hmm,
and yet giving a little in this doesn't mean the whole thing will be lost. Because I think
exactly.
So many Jews feel that giving a little, not sending the settlers out there, means they lose it all. They risk losing it all.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the start of a good answer. But we need to discuss it some more. I gave you something which there's no time to talk about, but it's an attempt to talk about hope in a political context. And I encourage you to read it. It's an example of what we do at the World Council and what someone like me working there has to work on. How do you interpret the Gaza pullout? How do you interpret the Gaza pullout last August, where, remember, the settlers were taken out of Gaza? And I really ask you to read this if you're interested in that question and compare it to what you heard on the news. And I'll be happy to explain why I think what's on this yellow paper is far more accurate than what you heard on the news about how to interpret that pullout. Let me close with, you said, where's the hope?
Jonathan, it's hope that you share with people, or I will just announce it. The ELCA has an excellent webpage on this and a listserv. So it's on Israel-Palestine. It's the Middle East Networking website. It's elca.org